Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be continuing in 2 Kings today, in 2 Kings 18. I don't know about you. I looked at last week's program, and I confused myself. There's just so much happening here that I want to try at the first of this program. Now, we're going to be dealing with the exile of Israel. So I want to try to go back through this historical overview again to try to help you get in your mind, if you can get it in your mind in a simple way, these major events, the rest of the Old Testament will fit in place. The Old Testament is not in chronological sequence, and that is what has just destroyed people who want to start with Genesis and read through Malachi. They get so confused because it's so out of sequence. Now, the chart I sent you several weeks ago is meant to give you an overview. And that'll be very helpful, and I hope you'll reproduce that for your students. Now, another thing that'll be helpful. Turn in the back of your Bible, or hopefully your classroom has a set of maps. Now, I want to show you the one that I use. This is a Broadman map here. I think it's very good. This is just one of the pages. This shows the top part of the map is the Babylonian Empire, and the bottom part of the map is the Assyrian Empire. Now, there's another set of maps somewhere in your Bible that has the Persian Empire. Now, those are the major world powers we're dealing with. We're not dealing with Egypt. That's the Exodus, okay? Egypt is not a major power during this period. She's going to have some little part in the book of Jeremiah, but very little, okay? So, if you can follow with me these major dates, and I really hope you'll get your folks to try to memorize these, you can put prophets and chronology and everything around these dates. I have a graphic I want to show you as we talk through these dates one more time. And remember, we're dealing with world powers, okay? Israel and Judah are going to split in 922. I hope you'll write that down. 922 is when Solomon's son loses the united monarchy, okay? Rehoboam, Jeroboam are the split. And then in 722, that's where we are right today, 722, Assyria is going to take Israel into exile. Now, a few years later, Babylon, the next major empire, is going to take Judah into exile. And then finally, the next major empire is Persia. Matter of fact, with numbers 2, 3, and 4, you could write out by the side or underline Assyria, Babylon, and then Cyrus is Persia. Okay? That's the next major world empire. If you want to follow through on this chart, the next major world empire is Cyrus the Great. That's Greece. If you read the book of Daniel, these all fit in. So we got Assyria, the Sumerians first, old Babylon, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Alexander the Great, Greece, the split of Alexander's kingdom by his four generals, Rome, and that takes us right up to the New Testament period and beyond. Now, the Maccabean Revolt is during those period when the four generals are in control of the world, Alexander's four generals. If you can see that, those big world empires that affect the people of God, and these major dates, it's going to really help you. Matter of fact, what would be the best thing you could ever do as a teacher is sit down, put these major dates, these major empires together, and then put the books of the Bible that fit into those empires. That chart I gave you will help you. Put Isaiah and Micah into that period of Judah, okay? In Assyrian Empire, and right on through, it'll help you so much. Okay, let's go then to chapter 2 Kings 18. Now, to fully understand 2 Kings 18, you need to read the parallel passages. 2 Chronicles chapter 29 through 32 must be read, and Isaiah chapters 36 through 39 must be read to fully understand what's happening. Okay, let's look at 2 Kings 18. Now, it came about in the third year of Hoshea, all right, the son of Eli, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, became king. We're dating the southern king by the northern king, and we're dating the northern king by the southern king. That's what sounds so confusing. That's all we're doing is telling you what year so-and-so began to reign in contrast to who was in the other kingdom. And that's what's happening all the way through here. There are tremendous dating problems through here that I won't get into with you, but there just are. Now, Hezekiah means the Lord my strength, son of Ahaz, okay, king of Judah, became king. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. Now, 14 years before leprosy, 15 years after leprosy, all right? And his mother's name was Abba, the daughter of Zechariah. All right? And he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father David had done. Now, there are only a few kings that are mentioned with such praise. David, of course, is praised over and over. But the other kings are Asa, Josiah, and Hezekiah are the three main Judean kings that are praised. Asa, Josiah, Hezekiah. Now, notice it says in verse 4, he removed the high places. We've talked so often about this, these high places. You ought to see 2 Chronicles 31:3. They were at one time Canaanite. They became Yahwistic, and now they had reverted back to Canaanite or fertility cult places. And Hezekiah had them removed. Excuse me. Now, and broke down the sacred pillars. The sacred pillars are stone, a stone, elongated stone, some things like a phallus. Broke them down, symbol of male fertility god, okay? He broke down the sacred pillars, cut down the Asherah, that is the symbol of the female Canaanite consort of Baal. Asherah, it was a wooden carved stake, all right? He also broke to pieces the bronze serpent that Moses has made. Now, you need to look in the margin of your reference Bible, and it'll take you back to Numbers 21. Remember how the people were griping about God's provision? They didn't like the manna. They didn't like the quail. And God got mad and said, all right, I'll just send fiery snakes. You just keep griping. And the snakes came into the camp. And they started biting people. And people started dying. People said, hey, that bread wasn't half bad. And I really like quail after all. And so they said, Moses, pray that God will remove the snakes. But God said, no, Moses, I will not remove the snakes. But you make a bronze image of that snake. Snake, and you put it up on a pole, and anyone who looks to that pole and believes in me, the snake bite won't kill him. Now, it was a great act of God of mercy, but as all things happen, the people, years later, took that bronze serpent and made it an idol, and they were worshiping and offering sacrifice and burning incense to that bronze serpent. But that's one reason. I'm going to give you a little personal sideline here. That's one reason I believe we're never going to find the Ark of the Covenant. We're never going to find Noah's Ark. The Shroud of Turin, I really don't believe, is the Shroud of Jesus, because God knows that we are so prone toward idol worship. Even things that God gives us in good faith and for our well-being, we turn into idols. And so God's just taken all that away from us. And here's an example of the serpent had to be burned because it had become an idol. Now, notice the name. It was called Neshtistan. Neshtistan. Now, this, in Hebrew, there's a play on words between the title of this snake and the word for brass. And there's a play on words we wouldn't catch there. For a fuller treatment of this reform that Hezekiah instituted, 2 Chronicles 29 through 31 will give you the full reform. He was a very good king, a godly king, which is surprising because his father was one of the worst kings that that Judah ever had. Now, notice it says, he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that after him there was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among those who were before him. Now, this same phrase is used of Joshua and Moses, those kind of people. So he clung to the Lord. The word clung here is just like Genesis 2:26. The literal meaning is glued himself to the Lord. Y'all see Genesis 2:24, excuse me. And did not depart from following him. Now, there's many of these Judean kings that started out so well. They really did. They started out so good. But in later life, they fell away. I think of Joshua. And on and on. So this was another example. He was faithful all his life. Now, notice if you would what it mentions here. And the Lord was with him. This is also said of Moses, Joshua, David. Wherever he went, he prospered. And he rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. Now, this is probably, we can't be certain through here, probably Sargon II we're talking about. Now, he was the king of Assyria from 722 to 705 B.C. And he defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. Now, there, of course, the Philistine is a major enemy, had not been since the time of the Judges, okay? Minor skirmishes, but not a major problem since the period of Judges, Samson, all that. Now, what we have here, we learn from Assyrian records that Padi, Paddy, was a vassal king of this area under the Assyrian monarch, and probably Hezekiah just took the territory from this man and made this man a prisoner within the city of Jerusalem. Okay? That's what you're referring to here. Now, from watchtower to fortified city means from the smallest fortification to the largest fortification, Hezekiah captured the land. Now, it came about in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, that's the northern king, son of Elah, king of Israel, that's Salmaneser. Now, this is Salmaneser the fifth, 727 to 722 of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. Now, here is the fall, this northern kingdom, these ten tribes, 722 is when they fell. Assyrian records tell us that 27,290 people were exiled from the capital of Samaria alone. All right? And at the end of 3 years, they captured it in the sixth year of Hezekiah, which is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel. Samaria was captured, 722 B.C. What we have here is two different kings, and I get them so confused. Salmaneser the fifth started the siege, but he didn't finish it. Sargon the second, his son, finished the siege. And so we have two kings between the start of the siege of Samaria and its capture. Now let's continue then. Then the king of Assyria carried Israel away into exile to Syria and put in Halah on the harbor and the river Gozan in the city of the Medes. Now, we talked earlier, the exiled people from Israel were taken to the headwaters of the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley in the area of Meda, okay? This is where Abraham sojourned to Haran. Now, the people from Babylon that Assyria had captured, old Babylon, he imported them into the nation of Israel. And we talked about that last week, okay? Notice verse 13. Now, in the 14th year of Hezekiah, there's real dating problems here. Y'all see Isaiah 36:1 through 39:8. Sennacherib, that's the next king of Assyria, all right? 705 to 681. King of Assyria came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and seized them. Probably this happened around 701 B.C., 701, you'll write that in your Bible, right next to verse 13. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. Now, Lachish is a major, major fortified city to the west of Jerusalem. So apparently Sennacherib's army had done destroyed most of the villages and was besieging Lachish. Now, Hezekiah sent and asked them to make a deal with him. He's going to try to buy this king off first. I have a graphic that will show you what was spent to try to buy Sennacherib off. If we could see that graphic, please. Notice there are several things there. He had to surrender all the land and become a vassal king. Hezekiah had to give up the Ekron, the king of Ekron, Paddy. Remember I mentioned him earlier? Had to give him up. Hezekiah's daughters had to be taken to Sennacherib's harem. A huge payment of 30 talents of gold and 800 talents of silver, and then many clothes and jewelry and furs and things like that that were considered wealth in that day. But friends, it didn't work. It didn't buy him off. Now, some say there's two different invasions, but I really think it's the same invasion. Hezekiah tried to buy his way out, but the king took all this stuff and then reneged on the deal and besieged Jerusalem anyway. Okay, saying, I have done wrong, withdraw from me, whatever you impose on me, I will bear. So the king of Assyria required Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. We have it recorded in the Bible. The rest of those things I gave you are recorded in these Assyrian records, okay? And Hezekiah gave him all the silver which was found in the Lord's house. Now, there wasn't a whole lot left because Ahaz had done the very same thing earlier in chapter 16, verse 3. So there wasn't a whole lot of gold and silver left. At that time, Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord. He had replaced the bronze with gold, but took it off again, which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid. Y'all see 2 Chronicles 29, verses 17 through 19, and gave it to the king of Assyria. Now, verse 17. Then the king of Assyria. Now, there are three names mentioned here. I'm using the New American Standard Translation. I have Tartan, Rabsaris, and Rabishak. Now, those seem like proper names in the New American Standard Version. They are not proper names. They are technical Assyrian terms for Assyrian officials. Now, I have a graphic. I'll show you where you can see what these names mean. The first one here, basically, is the military commander-in-chief. The second one is the chief eunuch, and the third one is the chief cupbearer. And so these are technical Syrian names that refer to different officers in Sennacherib's army. Notice it mentions the conduit of the upper pool. Remember that there was a special Hezekiah's tunnel that's still there today, by the way, was drilled underground to secure the water supply of Jerusalem during sieges. And so a well outside the walls was hidden and a tunnel underneath the ground to bring that water into the city. And that's the area we're talking about right now. Verse 18, three of Hezekiah's officials went to meet the three Assyrian officials. Notice verse 19. One of the officials is saying, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what is this confidence that you have?" The king of Assyria is trying to intimidate Hezekiah. "You say," but they are only empty words, "I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom do you rely that you have rebelled against me?" Now what we're talking about here, look at verse 21. "And behold, you rely on the staff of a crushed reed, even on Egypt." Now, these reeds that grew in the Nile River Valley were long and tall. They looked very strong, but they were very, very brittle. You ought to see Isaiah 30, verses 1 through 4. Hezekiah was trying to go to Egypt, just like everybody else tried to do in Israel and this promised land, for help against these major world powers of the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. It never worked out, and it wasn't going to work out here. And look at this. Look at verse 22. "But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,'" boy, this guy, these people are really knocking down Hezekiah's, what word should I use? The things that he was popular with the people for. "Is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away?" These guys said, "Hezekiah tells you trust in the Lord. But look, Hezekiah is the one that took away the local shrines. He is the one that won't let you worship anymore at the high places. Do you think God's going to bless Hezekiah when Hezekiah took away his worship places?" Look at this next part in verse 23. What sarcasm's here. "Now therefore come and make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria, and I will give you 2,000 horses if you're able to put, for your part, riders on them." What this guy is saying is, look, we have military hardware and surplus. We can provide you 2,000 cavalry mounts. But Judah, you can't even put men on them. You're so weak militarily. We have surplus, and you're gonna stand against us. Now, notice this last one. "How then can you repulse one official, the least of my master's servants, and rely on Egypt for chariots and horsemen?" Look at verse 25. "Now I come up without the Lord's approval against this land to destroy it. For the Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.'" Now verse 25 is a good evidence we have that when armies came into a geographical region, they would offer sacrifice to the local deity. The local deity. And so apparently they had offered sacrifice. The Assyrian army had offered sacrifices to Yahweh, and supposedly these Assyrian priests had heard Yahweh speak that he was giving them the land. Boy, I tell you what. Now, look at verse 26. "These three servants of Hezekiah said, 'Please, sirs, speak to us in Aramaic, for we understand it. Don't speak in Hebrew. We do not want the people to hear.' And the three servants of Sennacherib said, 'We're going to speak in Hebrew because we want that man on the wall who's going to die and have to eat his own dung and drink his own urine. We want him to know it's going to happen and why.'" Now, you see, that sounds gross. Well, that was what actually happened during sieges. Food ran out. Water ran out. It was really terrible. You can just, verse 27 accurately describes what a siege is like. Look at verse 29. They're trying to convince the people against Hezekiah and his faith in God. "Thus says the king, 'Do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you out of my hand.'" And on it goes down through here. And look at verse 33. "Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered his land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sopharim, Hena, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria from my hands?" That's what he's saying. This subtle, subtle temptation. "I am the king of Assyria. I have captured every nation I've come against. The gods of those nations have not saved them. No national deity has been able to withstand my army. And listen, Judah, I even captured Israel. The same God you trust in couldn't protect the northern 10 tribes. Why do you think this same God will protect you?" Ooh, what a subtle temptation. What a subtle blasphemy against Yahweh. And look at verse 37. Those men tore their clothes because it was a sign of blasphemy what these men have said. Now, I'm not going to go into chapter 19, but that's the whole account. You need to read that to fully teach this lesson. This is how Isaiah finally convinces Hezekiah to trust in God and that God will protect this city. Every other city has fallen. Every other nation has fallen. But Isaiah says, trust God, Hezekiah. Trust Him. He'll deliver you. Well, Hezekiah had enough faith to believe Isaiah. And he trusted God when all the odds and all the circumstances and all the historical precedents went against him. And God delivered him this army. If you look at the same chapter over toward the end of chapter 19, look at verse 35. The death angel came and 185,000 Assyrian army men died in one night. Sennacherib left the next day and went back to Assyria. Now, friends, I think there's great promise here, and I want to deal in this program about two ways. There is a subtle temptation to say, well, did God do that here or there? It's to always see what God has done in other places and say, well, God will do that for me. If Hezekiah would have taken that, he would have surrendered because there was no historical precedent. Now, later on, Judah, of course, is going to be saved, and it's going to be 160 more years before they finally fall. In Jeremiah's day, now that's years later from Isaiah's day, the people said, hey, God's going to protect this city. He protected it once against Sennacherib, and he'll protect it against Nebuchadnezzar II. But friends, the promises that God made to Hezekiah in his day are not automatically valid to Jeremiah's day. That's what I'm saying. I want you to listen to me good, because this is confusing, I think. I think we can depend on the promises of God. But I want you to know the promises of God are always conditioned on our faith response. Religion, our biblical faith, is not primarily a mechanical thing. It is a relational thing. You can't say, God said it, that settles it. You can't say that. Because although God said it, your faith has to enter in before it settles it. Now, God's word is sure, and we can depend on His promises, but there is a faith response demanded to make God's promises optional. And it's not, we can't say, well, God said it, therefore anything I do doesn't make any difference. No, friends, what you do, your attitude, your heart, your response. Isaiah and Hezekiah acted in faith, and God delivered that nation. But I want to tell you, Jeremiah and the people of his day did. Jeremiah acted in faith, but the people acted in tradition and trusting in the promises of God in the past, but did not have a personal relationship with God. And friends, I want you to know, this city finally fell. And when it fell, it failed. The temple fell. The city fell. Everything was destroyed. We can trust in the promises of God. But friends, you dare not take the promises of God as a presumption for you to act without faith and without love and without relationship with God. The promises of the Bible are not mechanical. They are relational. Now, I think they're valid and they're true and they can be depended on, but it depends on God's grace and your faith. And you've got to make sure, you've got to make sure that it's God's will and that you respond to it openly. Now, here we have an example of this happening, but later on it's not going to happen. Now, this whole account is a beautiful, beautiful faith builder. This is one of the most significant accounts that, in the whole Bible, I think, of God showing His arm and His power. And I hope that you can convey something of the need for faith in our lives today. As God acted so decisively in history, our God is still alive, and He is going to act decisively in our lives, in our day, if we find His will and trust Him by faith. Now, both those are crucial, absolutely crucial. What a marvelous account of the power of God against all human obstacles and all human resources and all human power structures. Our God is able to accomplish His will in history, in the lives of nations, and the lives of individuals, if we trust Him and know Him and obey His commands. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again same time, same place next week.